It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. What does it mean to speak the language of chefs? Well, if you're restaurant designer Jimmy Yui, it means you know exactly what they want in their kitchens. And big is not necessarily better. It's not the walk-in refrigerators or the humongous stoves. It's often about the small things.
Ultimately, I have chefs that will say, where do I put my tongue? Where is this garnish? Where is the plate? Where is... And in a perfect world, I get to do all of those things standing in one place. I don't really want to take more than a step.
The Art of the Restaurant and the Happy Pig Project in Hungary. Stick around. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When it comes to basic flavors like salt or sweet, bitter is nature's dare. In the plant world, bitter can, but not always, mean poison, which is why babies are wired to reject it big time. But as we age, bitter gains an alluring edge. Nothing equals what it brings to foods. Think bittersweet chocolate, strong coffee, a cold beer, garlicky broccoli rabe. I mean, we all know the taste, but that's about it. Jennifer McLaughlin has written a number of award-winning single-topic books, Bones, Fat, Odd Bits, and now she's out with the story behind this taste. The book is Bitter, a taste of the world's most dangerous flavor, with recipes. Jennifer, great to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
Okay, bitter, the world's most dangerous flavor. What are we talking about here?
Because bitter can be dangerous, you know, bitter can signal a poison or a toxin, so we have this innate reaction of negativeness to bitterness. So the reason for me writing the book is to try and help people overcome that negative reaction to bitter and try and see it as a positive taste, because now we're not really worried about eating anything poisonous that we buy in the supermarket or the grocery store.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about, we talk about the basic flavors, salty, sweet, sour, I would add now hot, as in chili. They're pretty easy to nail down, but bitter's more elusive. Why is that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I thought I knew what bitterness was. And I asked friends about, you know, to give me some suggestions to put in the book. And they came back with, you know, what I expected, things like rapini, beer, coffee, citrus zest. But also some of them suggested rhubarb or like pickled onions or sorrel, which for me aren't bitter at all. They're actually sour. And that's when I thought, you know, I'm really going to have to think about what bitterness means. And I talked to a couple of food scientists who specialize in taste. And they said bitter and sour are often confused because in large amounts we have a negative reaction to both of them. So people get those confused in their head. But only acids give you a sour response, whereas there's over 1,000 different chemicals that elicit a bitter response. So bitter is much more complex, I think, than all the other flavors. It ranges from like a mild bitterness like celery leaves all the way through to something like bitter gourd, which is very bitter.
This must mean that it's registering in the brain in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because actually it's our brain that's creating flavor and all the other senses come into play. You know, our taste buds, there's our sense of smell. You know, I would argue that you can smell bitterness.
That's interesting, yeah.
You know, think about when you smell dandelions or maybe burnt toast or roasting coffee. That will give your brain an impression of bitterness.
It's a good point. Yeah, you can.
And then we can see taste. You know, it's interesting because I didn't realize this before working on the book, that actually the biggest influence on how we taste is what we see. You know, people always say you eat with your eyes.
Right.
And usually they're referring to pretty photographs in cookbooks. But we actually do eat with our eyes. You know, half our brain is devoted to processing, you know, visual information. And so it uses all these shortcuts to do it quickly. And color is one way. So, and that happens with food. Like if we see something that's red, we assume, especially in Western culture, that's going to be sweet. You know, it's like Campari. It's bitter, but I think we perceive it as being less bitter or more sweet than it is because it's
red.
It's
bright
red. Yeah. And there was also interesting, you know, Heston Blumenthal, the molecular chef, he had on his menu a beetroot and orange jelly, which of course was orange and dark purple. But not till people closed their eyes did they understand that the dark purple was blood orange and the orange side was beetroot, orange beets. Because their brain just said, okay, that's the orange side. That tastes like orange and that tastes – but it
right.
was totally reversed, right? But their eyes were tricking them into perceiving that.
Right, right. But bitter sounds like it's more complicated than the other flavors are.
Yeah, I think so. I think because it has a bigger range. You know, we can feel bitter with our fingers and our lips and our teeth and the tongue. There's a nerve that runs down the side of your tongue, the trigeminal nerve. And, you know, that's the one responsible that gives you kind of a brain freeze when you have really cold ice cream.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also the same thing as, you know, when you have a mint, it feels cold, even though it's not cold. And a cognac feels warm, even though it's room temperature. And that also gives us pungency and tannin. So you sense bitterness in arugula from its pungency or in horseradish or the astringency in celery or the tannins in tea or cooked apricots is another one for me. I think they're bitter in a tannic sense.
Okay, but let's talk cooking now and the shadings of bitter. What are some of the things to know about using bitter?
I think one of the most important things is not to try and eliminate it. You know, people say, oh, it's bitter, they'll put some sugar in there. It's to try and balance bitterness with something else. So something salty, salt will often cut the bitterness, but something fatty, you know, I should have known this straight away, like fat and bitter are perfect partners. So if you have something rich and you match it with something bitter, they play off each other and they make each other taste even better.
So horseradish in whipped cream as
exactly,
a sauce.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
A magret de canard with a side of rapini.
Yeah, the duck breast. Oh, yeah, because the duck breast is almost sweet. It's so rich.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to think about using bitterness in something like a truffle.
Mm-hmm.
If you take your truffle and you roll it in cocoa powder instead of in confectionery sugar, you get a much more interesting, complex flavor because
yeah.
you get that bitterness on your tongue with the cocoa, and then afterwards you get the chocolate. So it balances. It's not just sweet, sweet, sweet one tone. It's many different things in your mouth there. You're getting all those different kind of complex, intriguing flavors together. Or a salad's the same thing, you know. Maybe you don't want all bitter greens, but if you mix a regular salad and you add some celery leaves and you add some escarole and Belgian endive and radicchio for color, you get a really interesting salad.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn, and embrace bitterness.
I will. Jennifer McLaughlin is author of Bitter. Now, for a bit of fun, she left us with a recipe for beer jelly, a.k.a. Jell-O, made from wheat beer. She serves it with smoked fish or salami or pickles as a palate cleanser with little bites. Sound interesting? Well, make it and report back. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. We have a tale for you about a pig in Hungary. A pig so delicious it was once considered fit only for the emperor's table. But that pig under the years of communism fell out of favor. Today, however, it's enjoying a revival. The BBC's Lucy Hooker has the story.
Józsi, hajts fel a sertéseket, légy szíves! Jöhetnek! Hogy jöjjenek!
We're at a small family-owned farm about 180 kilometers east of Budapest,
all around us in this muddy, straw-strewn field, there are puddles and pigs wallowing in the mud. But these are pigs like none I've ever seen before. Instead of smooth coats, they have curly, fluffy coats, much more like a sheep than a pig.
It's a woolly pig. And long distance, the people confuse with sheep. And it's also very fatty. The shape of the animal is like a ball. So it's a cute animal.
The cute animals are Mangalitsa pigs, belonging to a local farming family, Lajos Palotzi and his daughters. But it's Peter Tolt, head of the organisation representing breeders of this remarkable animal, who's showing me around.
Those animals here are happy, satisfied. And the good life for the pig, what means? Eat too much and make sex. A lot of piglets. So the two things that we need. So this is a good cooperation.
But the history of the Mangalitsa is not a happy one. These curious-looking animals were first bred in the early 19th century for the table of the Austro-Hungarian emperors. Soon almost every pig in Hungary was a Mangalitsa. But when Hungary became communist following the Second World War, the Mangalitsa fell dramatically out of favour. Farms were collectivised. The aim of the meat industry was to provide cheap and plentiful food for the masses. The Mangalitsa, which takes a year and a half to mature and needs to roam freely outdoors, was seen as old-fashioned and useless. It was only once the country opened up again after 1989 that Peter saw a chance to save the breed.
We had the vision. We had the vision that we told to the people, don't give up, fight, fight more, save the Mangalitsa because we have the future.
With Hungary's borders open to the west, Peter discovered that Spain's ham makers had an insatiable need for fatty hams. If he could resurrect Hungary's fattiest pig, he could meet that demand.
Yes, in the first 3-4 years it was like an adventure because no internet, no mobile phones, no nothing. So we sent in letters, thousands of letters to different breeders that you have Mangalitsa or some strange looking hairy pig. The old people in the village, that do you remember some people have Mangalitsa on? So we collected the last 200. And a lot of cases I bought the live Mangalitsa just before going to the slaughterhouse. It was saving the animal from the extinction.
These days, Spain still buys 90% of Hungary's Mangalitsa production to make cured hams. But there's a growing demand from market restaurants, from Tokyo to New York, and the meat fetches 3 or 4 times the price of ordinary pork.
We can see that this carcass is quite different than the people can see in a normal meat shop.
So this bit here, this is what, a loin?
This is a loin, and you can see the tenderloin.
I can recognise a trotter.
Yes, of course. Yes, a feet. And you can see that the colour of the meat, it's dark red, like beef meat. Maybe this is the reason that some countries, the people in restaurants, call the Mangalitsa meat Kobe pig. So like, it's a reference to the very well-marbled Japanese Kobe beef. Because all of the taste, it's coming from the fat. The fatless meat, it is tasteless meat.
So, Peter, who is it who has an appetite now for Mangalitsa pork?
I can say that nearly everybody. So if somebody like pork meat, will love the Mangalitsa meat. If somebody tried the Mangalitsa meat, normally say that, oh, this is the pork that I tasted when I was young. So it remembers us to the golden era of the pig production.
Shall we go out and see one or two more pigs before we go?
Okay.
That was reporter Lucy Hooker reporting for the BBC. Well, we can't resist leaving you with a recipe, but one where no pigs are harmed. Check out Patty Hinnich's delicious and adorable piggy cookies on the website splendidtable.org. Coming up, first-rate, off-the-beaten-track American wines and what obsessive madness lies behind good restaurant design. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rosetter Casper. Food & Wine magazine's Ray Isle tastes a lot of wine every year. The good, the bad, and the just plain awful. Well, he's been noticing a sea change of sorts in some of the wines from the United States. Not the wines from California or Washington or Oregon, but the wines from Texas, New York, Virginia, and Arizona. Our contributor, Noelle Carter, talked to Ray.
Ray, it's such a pleasure to talk to you today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
One interesting statistic that you mentioned is that as recently as just a few years ago, wine was produced in all of our 50 states.
It's really quite surprising. I mean, you know, there actually is quite a long history of wine being produced in states other than the West Coast states that everybody's familiar with, the California, Oregon, Washington kind of axis. You know, if you go back, wine's been produced in Missouri for quite a long time, for instance.
Wow.
But to have wine produced in every state in the union is really kind of remarkable, especially states that you wouldn't expect, like Hawaii.
You know, it's funny. When I think of good wine, I think of wine produced on the West Coast. But if I were to think of, say, wine made in the Midwest or, you know, in the South somewhere, I don't necessarily think of it as being of the quality that I would want to buy.
You know, I think that's changing, actually, which is really exciting from a wine point of view, from a wine writing point of view. In the past, it has been very tough to find good wines in the kind of non-West Coast states. I think over the past, let's say, 7 to 8 years, there's been little pockets of really ambitious winemaking that have kind of sprung up in places like Virginia, Texas, Arizona, Michigan, the Finger Lakes in New York, which has been going on for quite a while, actually. And, you know, you're starting to see wines that are quite competitive with what you would get out of California or Washington or Oregon. And it's exciting, especially, you know, as we sort of fall more and more into this idea of eating locally, it's nice to be able to drink wine locally, too.
You know, in your article, I love how you mentioned you were traveling with your father a few years ago through Texas and, you know, you tried some of the wines and you weren't as impressed. And then just last year, you did a food and wine tasting and you were blown away by the results. Can you describe some of the eye-opening experiences that you've had recently with some of these regional American wines?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, that Texas situation was classic because I did travel. I took it was a great fun. I took a trip through Texas, you know, and I'm from Texas. So it was kind of father, son, you know, traipsing through my home state. But this was 7 or 8 years ago, and the wines we tasted, we kept going to these wineries, having a great time, and then thinking, oh, it wasn't that great. And I came back to the Austin Wine and Food Festival a couple of years ago and was on a panel with a group of Texas wines, as what we were pouring for the audience. And I tasted these wines and I had a little bit of trepidation because it's that awkward thing where you're on a panel, you know, in your home state with a bunch of wines and you hope they're going to be good. And in fact, they were terrific. They were really, really fantastic wines. And that was the kind of the beginning of this thought process. Shortly after that, I was at a tasting in Christie's in New York, the auction house, where Jancis Robinson, who's a English wine critic, had brought, among other things, we were tasting a whole bunch of different wines, but one of them was a Bordeaux-style blend from Virginia, of all places. And she said, you know, I think this is a really remarkable wine. And we all tasted it and thought, geez, you know, no lie, that is, in fact, a really remarkable wine, which got me thinking. And so I spent some time traveling through Virginia tasting wines, and the top wines coming out of Virginia are really spectacular. And then because I live in New York, I'd been following the Finger Lakes, which I think is kind of inarguably the best Riesling producing region in the U.S.
Wow.
And then, you know, after that, a wine director down in Scottsdale, Pavle Milic, had gotten in touch with me about Arizona wines, and I tasted some samples and things and thought, you know, they're doing some really interesting things with Rhone variety grapes, Syrah, Grenache, in this high Sonoita desert area. And Michigan, northern Michigan, actually, the places like the Leelanau Peninsula, you've got some really, really nice Rieslings coming from Michigan. And, you know, there's some terrific wines coming out of Missouri as well. And it's, you know, it all kind of coalesced into this idea that there's kind of, whether it's a renaissance or a tipping point or whatever term you want to use for it, there's something going on where these states that aren't the West Coast states, there's suddenly a real kind of, you know, burst of creative energy in terms of winemaking, which is incredibly exciting.
And I would imagine, are those local wines much more difficult to find?
Well, if you're in the state where they're produced, they're actually usually quite easy to find because you can go directly to the winery, among other things. The trick for a lot of these wineries is getting some kind of national distribution, and that's pretty tough. So it can be very difficult, for instance, to get Texas wines if you're in Idaho. And that's partly the vagaries of the wine distribution system in the U.S. And it's partly because it's honestly a little bit, you know, one of the big selling points they have is the local thing. It's, you know, you can sell Texas wine in Texas much more easily than you can sell it in Idaho. But I'm hoping that, you know, eventually the U.S. ends up, you know, in a way like France is, where it's not uncommon to see wines from the Languedoc in Paris. You know, it's, you know, the different regions of France have distribution through the country, and that, you know, there's no reason why the U.S. couldn't head down that road eventually too, and it wouldn't be strange to see an Arizona wine on a New York wine list.
That's great. Ray, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Ray Isle is executive wine editor of Food & Wine magazine. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director, and she writes the Culinary SOS column. Head to splendidtable.org to get Ray's picks of the best of off-the-beaten-track American wines. Born into a restaurant family, Jimmy Huey always felt that chefs were true artists. And so, after studying architecture, he decided to use his design skills to help them realize their creativity. For almost 30 years, he's designed kitchens for the likes of Mario Batali, Eric Ripert, and Masaharu Morimoto. But he prides himself on the fact that you may never know it from looking at them, because he insists that every kitchen he works on reflects the personality of the chef, not the designer. Francis Lamb talked with Jimmy about how to get chefs to dream up their ideal kitchens.
So, Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I love the show.
You know, I think so much of design is really about listening, right? One of the hardest things I think that I've heard designers say to me is how you know what a client really wants. And a lot of it is really about getting to know your client and getting into their head and imagining you're them so you can start to intuit what it is that they need and what it is they want. And in your work, when you're working with chefs, how do you do that? What's the first thing you do when you start talking to a chef about their dream kitchen?
Well, that's actually spot on. I think any decent designer will tell you that what we really do is listen really, really hard. And intuit is a good word. We really have to get into their head and understand the nuances of what they're actually trying to articulate to you. With chefs, what we usually do, lucky for me, is we always start out with chef saying, you have to come to the restaurant, sit down, eat my food, and then next, hang around the kitchen, watch service for as long and as many services as you can muster. And it's very, very important because, one, in eating their food, they're actually trying to show you what their soul is about, what their product is about, what their art is about. It's really, really important. And then the second part of it is the execution. And watching the cooks in a kitchen, I like to think of it as very much a dance that occurs, with a chef being a conductor in front of an orchestra. And watching the movement is really, really important because you need to understand what kind of motion is necessary to produce the art that they're trying to produce.
Hmm. Is it helpful if the kitchen designer actually knows how to cook him or herself?
I think it's paramount. I'm not entirely sure how, if you didn't know how to cook at all, if you weren't interested in food, if you weren't excited about learning about what the chef is doing, I can't imagine how one would go about finessing some of these details. In our world, it's very, very important to pursue those ideas, sometimes to minuscule detail. Ultimately, I have chefs that will say, where do I put my tongue? Where is this garnish? Where is the plate? Where is, and in a perfect world, I get to do all of those things standing in one place. I don't really want to take more than a step. So you can imagine if you have a large menu, all of a sudden your station gets pretty dense. Mm-hmm. But that's what we try to accomplish.
Right. It's funny. The irony is, you know, a lot of people, when you ask them in their home kitchen, oh, what do you want in your home kitchen? All they want is big. I want a big counter, big stove, big refrigerator. And it's almost like in the restaurant, it's like, how small can we make everything?
It's really true. So I actually kind of hate most people's kitchens. Right, because you know the triangle, you know, the stove, the sink, and the refrigerator. But nobody ever says that the stove, sink, and the refrigerator being a 20-foot triangle is a terrible thing, right? You know, just because you got a triangle doesn't mean that it's particularly efficient. But it goes back to just as chefs and cooks in professional kitchens concentrate on mise en place. You know, you and I, if we were going to do a dinner together, the first thing you and I would do is think about the menu, and we would spend the first many, many hours actually doing all the prep work, right? And we would chop and organize and have containers of all the components, have all the tools lined up, and the outcome, the plates and the platters, that would have to be organized at the other end. And then you start. And that's essentially what professional cooks do day in and day out. Their mise en place is so important because you and I both want to show up at a restaurant at 7 p.m., along with the 1,000 other people who want to do the same thing. You all sit down, and everybody winds up ordering essentially at the same time. The order printer in the kitchen starts spitting out four tops times 20 all at once, and the guys on the line are trying to prioritize, looking at the conductor, the chef, who is giving them instructions on what to do first. And if you think about it that way, you can imagine doing a really, really complicated dinner party at home, multiply that by 100, and needing to do that perfectly over and over and over again without fail. Right. That's what my clients do.
Right. Jimmy, can you tell us about a particular kitchen problem that you had to solve?
Sure. Once upon a time, some years ago, I had been hired to do a kitchen for Chef Greg Kuntz at the Time Warner building. He was pretty late in taking the space. So the space that we wound up with was actually a triangle. And the hypotenuse of the triangle was the glazed curtain wall looking at Columbus Circle, the view that everybody wants. The trouble, of course, is that this was kind of like an isosceles triangle that's skinny and long with a hypotenuse looking at the fountain and the smallest point being the connection to the mall. That was the entrance. And in fact, that was the public entrance as well as the receiving end of the building. So we had the problem of saying, well, you know, if product is coming in and out at the tip of the triangle, as well as trash leaving at the tip of the triangle, and customers are coming in and out at the tip of the triangle, then you have a real spatial problem of orientation. Normally, one would put the kitchen in the back of the space and leave the nicest view to the customer. In this instance, as hard as we could try, because of the shape of the space being a narrow triangle, the only rational way we could solve the problem was to put the kitchen on the curtain wall side. And we struggled with it until Greg Kuntz said, you know, we could have an open kitchen and the customers could be raised so that they're looking through the kitchen at Columbus Circle. And that's how that problem got solved. Of course, in the media, people thought it was a crazy, crazy idea. And I wish every time somebody said that, I wish I could say, listen, you know, it's not like we went out of our way to take away the window seat. It's simply that if we had done it the way you think you'd want to do it, the customers and the trash and the product would wind up crossing at the tip of the triangle, which would be untenable.
Although to your point about chefs being artists, I think the other rationale I always heard for that was, you know, Chef Kuntz really believed in his cooks and believed his cooks should have inspiration while they worked. And it's like he wanted to have the view.
Yeah. Well, yes. But, you know, I would say that that came after the fact that we could solve the problem no other way, you know. So we tried to solve these puzzles the best way the space allows us to. And, you know, I often tell my clients that spaces, whether they're triangle, trapezoidal, or looks like an amoeba, they all, in the end, have a special solution just because of the proportion of the space, the orientation of the space. There's a way that the puzzle wants to be solved. And you can either go with it, like in Chef Kunz's case, putting the kitchen against the window, or you can fight it. And you can usually tell the spaces that have been fought against because there's something fundamentally wrong, like you're walking by the bathroom at the wrong place, or the kitchen door is next to the entrance, or the coat room is nowhere to be found. I mean, those are all fundamental things that occur when you're fighting a space, and it really didn't want to be what it is. So you wind up with stuff all over the place and places that you really, really can't work with.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, it's been great talking with you, Jimmy. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Jimmy Huey is an award-winning restaurant designer. Francis Lamb is editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter and a monthly columnist for the New York Times Magazine. Relentless in their search for the best in fish shacks, barbecue joints, and supper clubs, Jane and Michael Stern track down good home food no matter where it takes them. A dream job, right? I wish I had thought of it. Well, they're the duo behind roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, great to have you guys back.
Hey, Len.
Hi, Len. So where have you been?
We have been to northernmost Idaho, way up in the panhandle, north of Sand Point, which is a beautiful town in and of itself. But north of Sand Point, if you want a seriously hearty breakfast, we have got the place for you. It's called the Hoot Owl Cafe.
Hoot Owl?
Hoot Owl.
What a great name.
It's a great name, and it is such a great place. I mean, before we even talk about the food, I mean, it is such a colorful kind of roadside diner. It's got the kind of place with slogans all over the place. It's got booths, but it's also got a counter with normal stools, plus a couple of stools that are tractor seats. In case you're a little homesick for your John Deere, you can sit there.
It's a teeny little town and very rural. And, you know, like the classic, you know, Stern take on these things, it's like when you walk in, if they don't know you, then every head swivels because it's all locals.
Yeah.
But the food is terrific.
It's a breakfast and lunch place, no dinner. And breakfast is what we had there. And it's big and hearty. The biscuits there, you have to, first of all, put out of your mind the typical lightweight, airy, fragile southern biscuit, because this is a kind of more northwest-style biscuit, a rib-sticking biscuit it's big. It's maybe the size of half a loaf of bread, and it's the consistency almost of cake. I mean, it's not sweet like cake, but it's very dense and rich.
And it's the underpinnings for something on the menu called Redneck Eggs Benedict, which has very little to do with Eggs Benedict as we know it. But it's these mega biscuits with sausage patties on them and wonderful country gravy.
Instead of hollandaise.
That's just studded with hunks of sausage. I mean, I think they do have a lot of logging in that area. You know, if I was a lumberjack, this is where I would fuel up every morning.
Are there eggs with the eggs?
Yeah, there are a couple of eggs somewhere under the gravy and on top of the biscuit. The other thing that's really good there is a chicken fried steak. I wouldn't call it an elegant chicken fried steak because it isn't, but it's like really good tender beef with a great crust, and it's got that good gravy on it. And I have to tell you, one small chicken fried steak, it will feed two people very handily.
Yeah, and I'm not a big fan of restaurants that people like only because the portions are huge, but this is great food, and the pancakes will droop over your plate like a Salvador Dali watch. Everything is northern Idaho-sized.
We should also mention that although it's not open for dinner, every Monday from 4 to 7, it serves as a community soup kitchen. All are welcome to come and eat for free.
That's incredible. That's really incredible. I was just thinking about the fact that there are two things that are bordering on being lost arts. And one is chicken fried steak. And the other is a really great hearty biscuit. And here
yes.
We've got them preserved. This is fabulous.
Have you ever been to that part of Idaho?
I haven't been to that part of Idaho. I've been
gorgeous
to southern Idaho, which is breathtaking.
Yes.
But
this is near Coeur d'Alene, and it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
I have no doubt. It's like it's one of those places where you feel like if you lived here, you just have to be a very happy person.
Yep.
And if you lived there, you'd have to really have a lot of down parkas for the winter.
Yeah, but you could eat these breakfasts, and that's fabulous.
That's true.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye, then.
Find roadfood.com's Jane and Michael Stern's picks at splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?
We are talking to you this hour. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's get right to your questions. We've got Denise calling from Kalua Kona, Hawaii. Denise, you're in my favorite part of the world.
Mine too, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
Where is Kalua Kona?
Kailua Kona is on the Big Island. It's on the west side of the Big Island, usually just referred to as Kona, but it is formally Kailua Kona.
Oh, so you're in coffee territory.
We are right in the heart of the Kona Coffee Belt, yes.
This is great. Well, did you have a question?
I do have a question. I have a guava tree that has been producing fruit now for a couple of years. So it's still quite young, but it's delicious fruit. It's called a ruby guava. They're about the size of an apple. Very thin skin, very juicy, very sweet, very pink. And I've kind of run out of ideas for what to do with my bumper crop and in subsequent years. So I'm trying to branch out a little bit,
right,
and get past the perennial favorites here of guava jelly, guava jam, guava nectar,
mm-hmm.
All of which I love and I've put up quite a bit of. But I'm looking more for something along the savory line. I tried making a barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
And it just really didn't work out very well.
Why
and
not?
So I'm, well, you know, I started with just kind of a basic recipe for a tomato-based barbecue sauce, and I swapped out the tomatoes with the guava. And
right.
The flavor of the guava got really muddied and really muddled, and it didn't taste like guava at all. So I'm missing something, or I think there's probably something that needs to be added to it. And I started with, like, just raw guava puree.
Right.
As opposed to something that was more cooked and condensed, like maybe my jam or my jelly. But I'm just thinking that it would be so delicious as a marinade or a barbecue sauce for meatballs or pork or chicken, or even fish, all of which we have an abundance of here in Kona.
Right, of course you do. Well, you know what I'm wondering? What about, I mean, you could boil down the guava juice, but I'm just wondering, guava juice, I mean, this is very simple, guava juice, a small amount of soy sauce, a little bit of rice vinegar to give it a little acidic kick, you know, just to boost the fruit contrasts.
Okay.
And then fresh ginger. And
oh,
just
okay.
that. And then if you wanted to, you know, you could go with a little bit of something hot in that, you know, a little shot of hot pepper. But that, as a marinade, would be fabulous, or as something that you would brush onto something as it's grilling or as it's slow roasting. And that could go on anything. It could go on any fish. It could go on chicken, it could go on pork, it could go on lamb and beef, you know, et cetera. And the other thing is, that's the kind of thing that, you know, cook some sweet potatoes and slice them and, you know, and then just pour that over, or toss green beans with it, or, you know, whatever. Also, imagine that with grilled papaya, and then you drizzle that on the papaya.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so something really simple where the guava is the main event and there's not a lot of stuff going on. And
yeah, and I think that really is the challenge, is that, you know, it's a wonderful flavor, but it's very easily overpowered by,
exactly.
by other things. So
yeah.
I really want that to shine through. I want you to know that you're having guava.
And you know, one of the tricks would be, if it's still not shining through enough, just pull back on the other ingredients, or do the reduction, boil it down. Although, you
okay.
know, the thing I find, though, that's so interesting, that there are certain fruits that when you heat them, they lose so much. And I'm just, you know, well, if you're cooking it, you're making a jelly and it comes through, it can take the heat. But you boil it down so that it's almost a syrup and then flavor it, and you'd have another kind of intensity to it.
Okay. So would I then just go ahead and do that first and then add the soy and the rice?
I would try it first with the straight puree of guava.
Okay. And just do it raw.
Do it raw.
And then, that.
Right. And then feel your way. Put a little soy sauce, taste it. Put a little grated ginger, taste it. You know, add a little bit of rice vinegar, taste it. You might want black pepper and a bit of salt, but you see, but taste your way.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
And,
sounds wonderful.
And every step of the way, even the ones that don't quite work are going to be very usable.
I think so. I love the idea of putting it on a grilled papaya, something else that we have in abundance here. So
yeah,
that's definitely a hit.
I think that would really work.
Great. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Well, just out of curiosity, me really miserable. What temperature is it there right now?
Well, it's still fairly early in the morning, but it's probably about 70.
That's what I thought. Thank you so much. Denise, thanks for a great call.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate your help. Aloha.
Aloha. 800-537-5252. And Facebook and Twitter. And you can send us an email at splendidtable.org. Jeannie in Indiana wants to know if beet greens are edible and how should she prepare them? They are not only edible, they're delicious. They have sort of a sweet undertone to them. And this is one of the things you can do with them. You can boil them, obviously, or steam them. But the other thing you can do is you can do a sauté, like, you know, with chopped tomato and a bit of onion. And then you chop up those beet greens. You add the beet greens to that mix. And you add a little bit of white wine and a little bit of water. And you cook and cook and cook until the beet greens are essentially sweet and very, very soft, and you're home free. Now, the other thing you can do, too, is lightly steam them, and then you serve them with a dressing on them. And one dressing that's dynamite is to use a bit of sour cream and a bit of mustard with some lemon and a bit of garlic. And you just daub it. You don't want too much. Just that combination. Fabulous. You can call us at 800-537-5252, and you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Carol from Portland, Oregon's on the line. Carol, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I am a vegetarian who lives with meat eaters, so I cook meat all of the time. And chicken is one of those things that is always a safe, easy thing, because I just brine it, and I know I'm not going to dry it out.
Right, right.
So I've been seeing a lot of things in the little foodie world about coffee brine, and I'm really curious, because I'm not going to taste the chicken. I'm not going to taste, you know, any of the pieces of it, but I'm really intrigued. And, of course, in Portland, we're downtown and everything else that is just amazing coffee. I'm just wondering, you know, what is the chemistry on it? You know, can I use the pan drippings to make a gravy?
Oh, sure.
How do I, you know what I mean?
It's absolutely.
What do I put with it?
The thing about a coffee brine, now remember, coffee's very acidic.
Right.
Okay. So when you do a coffee brine, you want to make sure you have enough water also, like a half and half or two-thirds coffee, one-third water, because of the acid content. Because acids can sometimes actually, it's a funny way to think of it, but they can constrict the cells of the meat. And,
okay.
Yeah. And you don't, I mean, they can actually kind of break it down a bit, and you don't want that. But the idea is, you know, your typical brine is more or less equal amounts of sugar and salt with liquid, and then whatever seasonings you want. So make half the liquid or two-thirds of the liquid coffee. The sugar is going to go a long way to keep the meat soft and delicious. And then what you can do with the coffee, I mean, you can do things with that, like using a bit of cocoa as well in the brine.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
Some chilies. You know, if you think a mole sauce.
Exactly.
Yeah, think of that kind of thing. And you can use a fair amount of chili before it's ever going to show up in flavor in the chicken. And then, you know, you generally, with a 4-pound chicken, you generally marinate about 2 hours. Let's say, not too long, or brine about 2 hours. And
Now, the pan juices are going to be a bit salty, but you can certainly use them to make a gravy. And the coffee, you know, coffee is one of those things where, have you ever heard of red-eye gravy for ham? It's a coffee gravy where you take really salty country ham, slice of it, you pan, brown it, and then you throw some coffee. And the idea was it was breakfast coffee because you'd have that with eggs in the morning. But the reality is that bitter edge gives a wonderful kind of balance to something fatty and delicious. And the pan juices will have fat in them. But yes, you can certainly, you're not going to be tasting them. That's the, have someone taste them and make sure they're not too salty to begin with.
Okay.
And then, yes, do your pan sauce.
Does it matter what type of coffee? Because, again, you know, you have your different roasts. You have a cold brew. I mean,
yeah, first of all, cold brew is almost sweet. And it would be a fabulous thing to use in a brine. Except I always want to drink it all.
Drink it, yes. Yeah. So good.
All right, how about this? Half for the chicken, half for you. But I would go the cold brew route. I think that would be really dynamite.
And then one other question, you know, when I cook a chicken, then I take what's left and I cook it down to get whatever I can for a bone broth and get the collagen to throw in future soups.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
Still, with the coffee, is that...
Sure. It's going to be different. It's just, you know, it's just going to be different. Again, if you're worried about it being super salty, that's one thing that you may want to be cautious about.
Okay.
And
wonderful.
And I think you are a noble woman to cook for a bunch of meat eaters.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for a great question.
Yes, thank you. It was a delight.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. You know, a lot of uses for coffee you just don't think about. You know, of course, in sweets and whatever, but steaming something over coffee. There's this wonderful recipe from Daniel Patterson, this very inventive chef in San Francisco, where you spread dark roasted coffee beans in a roasting pan. You make a whole layer of them, and then you roast carrots over that very slowly. A little expensive, but you would not believe the flavor. Marge is on the line from Pittsburgh. Marge, what's on your mind?
I've lived in my house for about 40 years. I love to cook. I need to downsize a little, and I'm just overwhelmed as to where to start because I don't want to part with anything.
Marge, we're in exactly the same boat. I'm downsizing as well, and I'm looking at the cupboards and cupboards of the cake pans and the, you know, all the equipment. I know now one thing. Do not give up any of your knives unless you really don't like them. What kinds of things have you collected?
Well, I've collected a lot of pots and pans, and I like them, and on occasion I use all of them, but I have far too many, and they're all, you know, a good quality.
Yeah.
I have a lot of spoons and measuring and that sort of thing. I have a lot of serving-type dishes, which I haven't used, but I love them and I don't want to part with them.
Oh, I know the feeling. As far as the measuring stuff goes, what you should do is go through all of your measuring cups and your measuring spoons and look for the ones that have on them USDA standard. And it usually is abbreviated STD. Those are the ones you want to keep. Because what I've discovered is there are measuring cups and measuring spoons that are totally incorrect. And also, you generally don't need more than two sets of any measuring item so that if one is in the dishwasher, you've got another one to work with. And all the others, you know, kiss them goodbye, tell them thank you very much for all the good service, but they should go to someone else who can use them. The other thing is to think about the pots and pans. You know, think about what you use constantly. What is in the sink almost all the time? And those are going to be the pans that you can't even think about giving away or getting rid of. Then think about, what do I use when I entertain? You know, when I'm cooking for a lot of people. Really be selective about, okay, you need at least one big, deep pot. You need at least one, you know, really big sauté pan. And the same is true for entertaining. You know, you need, for instance, I sometimes have people over and I do 3 pounds of pasta and I serve it in a very, you know, in an old wash bowl.
You know those old sets where you'd have the pitcher and you'd have the bowl? Well, I've got one that I really love, and that's what I serve in. I would never give that thing up, even if I'm, you know, living in a tiny, tiny place. But I don't need necessarily a lot of other big bowls like that. So think of the things that have the most attraction, the things that you look at and you say, I know how great that's going to look with my food in it. And that's what you keep. And after you get to three or four platters and three or four bowls, it's time to probably blow the whistle and say, enough.
That's what I have to do. That's my problem right there.
And, you know, think about passing them on in the family.
Okay.
You know, because that means, you know, it means a lot to have something from someone you love. And you can then use it. It's kind of nice. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care, Marge.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for being with us. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Naomi Dugreed, who said, bitter is the gatekeeper of adult taste. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.